People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. In a world where the people bow and pray to the neon gods they have made, the words of the prophets are written on the subway walls, the tenement halls. These are not your Old Testament prophets, the ones running around the hills in ancient cities, predicting doom if the people didn't mend their ways. They're not your 20th century prophets leading mass movements, working for change. They're ordinary people who do listen, who do speak, who open their eyes to see and use their voices to say, "Look, people, what's going on? This won't end well. Wake up." It's like the aircraft ground proximity warning device that even in dense fog senses the ground approaching and responds with an urgent, "Pull up, pull up." That is the voice of prophetic witness that's long been part of our faith tradition. Dense fog indeed. I just returned from attending a convocation at my former seminary, Meadville Lombard in Chicago, along with our ministerial intern, Elizabeth Ide, who will be there all month. And the stark message that accompanied every workshop, every worship, everything's changing. Ministerial training is changing radically because these new ministers will be leaders in a radically changed world. Unitarian Universalism is changing, must change. Our congregations and relationships are changing, must change. But also something new. This piece of humble and unselfconscious frankness from leaders and theologians of a religion that's traditionally prided itself on its ability to articulate in-depth intellectual analyses of power structures and social movements and models of oppression. For two intense days, here's what I heard. "Wake up. Everything is changing and there's no going back. What's going on? We actually have no earthly idea." Because, you know, it seems that we're living through what 20th century theologian Alfred North Whitehead called a zone of anarchy. One of those times in history when the way we've come to know how the world works is no longer true and new patterns are not yet established. A zone of anarchy, when the normal becomes unhinged. You can wake up one morning and see the news, and before you realize it, each mind-twisting event becomes a disturbing or sometimes an intriguing new normal. You can't begin to pinpoint a moment when the reality begins to shift. Was it when the Twin Towers fell? Or was it 10 years later? How could it happen that hundreds of people occupy Wall Street for months with about 40% public support when no political party dared even talk about income inequality before for fear of being accused of promoting class warfare, and we don't do that here. Finally, an African American is elected president and the racist pushback is breathtaking. Pretty much the same result on the misogyny front when a woman gets so close to power. Didn't we already fight those battles and mostly win? White people are just starting to find out about the horrific violence black people have been living with since the civil rights movement. But gay marriage is now the law of the land, this land. And who could have imagined we'd even be fighting over rights of trans people here? And terrorism suddenly can happen anywhere without even a plot. Mass shootings happen and people frantically buy more guns. A Supreme Court justice dies and the Senate refuses to replace him, and what can you do? Nothing. And there's nothing I can say about the presidential election campaign that you don't already know, except this. In the most horrified tone possible. Seriously? And to top off this profoundly incomplete litany with what for me, as a baby boomer, may be the most staggeringly mind-blowing, parallel universe-evoking, deer-in-the-headlights-worthy story of all, did I get this right? Did it actually happen that the U.S. intelligence community just confirmed that Russia interfered in a U.S. election and got the candidate they wanted elected, and the whole country is not totally freaking out about it? Most especially not the conservative part of the country? I can't even... A zone of anarchy when the normal becomes unhinged. What do you see here? What do you make of all of this? You know, there's a part of me that still feels normal and that wonders whether we're all like the proverbial frogs in the pot of boiling water, not feeling it coming to a boil because we're becoming accustomed to the temperature as it rises degree by degree. But maybe I need that clueless comfort to go on with life as I know it. And then there's this other part of me hearing this frantic voice saying, pull up, pull up. Nearly a century ago, the theology professor at Meadville Lombard, a young James Luther Adams, took a hiatus to go to Germany to study with some of the great liberal theologians of the times. It was 1935 in Germany. James Luther Adams, affectionately called JLA by generations of students, later became the greatest UU theologian of his time, in no small part due to his response to what he found developing in Germany. Germany's liberal churches hadn't foreseen the Nazi threat, and their response was to hold discussions about it. They had no resources of any sort to mount a resistance. On the other hand, the Orthodox German confessing church movement actively opposed Hitler at great personal risk to members. JLA was eventually questioned by the Gestapo and had to leave the country, but this whole experience changed his theology forever. He wrote, "In Nazi Germany, I soon came to the question, what is it in my preaching and my political action that would stop this? It is a liberal attitude to say that we keep ourselves informed and we read the best newspapers on these matters and perhaps join a voluntary association now and then, but to be involved with other people so that it costs and so that one exposes the evils of society requires something like conversion, something more than an attitude. It requires a sense that there's something wrong, and I must be different from the way I have been." And just as the liberal faith tradition had long taught what's called the priesthood of all believers, that every person has direct access to the ultimate resources of the religious life, JLA began to teach what he called the prophethood of all believers. A Unitarian Universalist church, a prophetic church, is not where the prophetic function is assigned to the minister or a social justice committee or team. It's the church where every person thinks and works together to interpret the signs of the times in the light of their faith, to speak their truths about what they think is happening. And all members share in the common responsibility to try to foresee the consequences, and then to act with intention instead of merely being pushed around by history. When the normal becomes unhinged, anything's possible. With vast uncertainty comes intense feelings of fear and dread, but such a time is also the birthplace of possibility. As we watch and wait together, trying to interpret the signs, it's also a time to feel for those who are afraid, including ourselves. Most especially, it's the time to embrace those who are most vulnerable. And it's a time to create and amplify the joyfulness and the deep love for life that's the most precious gift of our faith tradition. Who are the prophets? We all are. But how can this work to become a community of prophecy? We're not all activists who come here to be, we also come here to be nurtured and renewed every bit as much as we come here to work in solidarity to defy hate. We're busy, we're tired, we each have other obligations, and we still have to run this congregation, which is no small order. We're a deliberately diverse people in our spiritual beliefs, so how can they be our roots and wings that ground and carry us in this work? What does it mean to be a community of resistance and renewal? A community of prophecy. At the convocation, we heard a story from the First UU Church of Austin, Texas. A woman, Sulma Franco, a lesbian activist from Guatemala, had approached the church asking for sanctuary. Guatemala is one of the main offenders in violence against the LGBTQ community, and Sulma had a target on her back if she returned home. ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, had denied her request for asylum, and they had set the date for her deportation. It's a tradition, still honored by law enforcement, not to enter private church property to arrest an asylum seeker. If the church offered sanctuary, Sulma would not be able to leave the premises for months, and possibly longer. They'd have to make a living space. They'd have to build a shower. Who knew the true legal implications or the reaction from some of the conservative members of the congregation or the surrounding community? And the minister was nervous about the whole idea, she told us, worried that more consideration was needed before the church jumped into this. But the deportation date was looming. She expressed her ambivalence at the board meeting, but then a board member said, "This is our mission. If we don't do this, what would we do?" And they did it. For months, First UU provided the space, the food, the companionship, the shower. They held press conferences. They negotiated with ICE. And finally, with private but not public assurances from the government that Sulma would not be arrested, the two ministers, each holding on to one arm of a terrified Sulma, escorted her into the federal building, where in fact she was granted temporary asylum and allowed to leave. The church had called the press and interfaith partners as witnesses, and a group of congregants was prepared to place their bodies between Sulma and the ICE agents if any attempt were made to take her. But this is a story with a happy ending. These activists who show up for rallies, march and demonstrations, who hold press conferences and publicly speak truth to power, who walk the halls of the Capitol looking for legislators to lobby and who write letters to the editor, who risk arrest, they are the bodies and the voices that bring our message to the world. Wake up, resist. But this isn't political activism we're doing. As UUs, we are living our faith in the world, and it's important that each one of us understand what it means to be part of a spiritually progressive movement. A spiritual, progressive spirituality is deeply rooted in evolving scientific understanding. It's consistent with the values of a modern liberal society. It has a healthy perspective of humanity's relationship to the rest of the natural world, and maybe most importantly, it's a spirituality not bound up with patriarchal, white, heteronormal beliefs and structures. It is deeply and radically inclusive. Without the spiritual grounding, this work of transforming the world, of defying hate and embracing the vulnerable, this is just burnout waiting to happen. The resistance can't function without renewal and sustenance, and that is work we all do for one another. People on the front lines can't do this alone. Like the poem that Jonathan read, like the story for all ages, we heard that this takes all of our diverse gifts and talents and interests and expertise. It takes a willingness to nurture and learn from one another. We have all the resources we need to sustain us for what will be a long struggle, even as we acknowledge and honor that we each have limitations, physical, financial, social anxieties, transportation, childcare, work and family obligations, and more. We have all of you. Talented musicians willing to step up and answer the call to help shape a message with beauty and energy, with reverence and joy, to bring us together to feel that spirit of transformation. We have teachers to care for our children, to tell them the stories of our tradition, to listen to their fears and their hopes, and help raise them to recognize and resist oppression. We have people who make sure we have a safe and functional and lovely building to meet in, people who bring in speakers who increase our understanding of the issues that affect our communities. We have caregivers who know how to be there when someone's having a hard time, someone to listen with compassion, and others to bring warm soup or offer rides or watch the children or do the laundry. We have visual artists who create beauty, crafting banners and altars and logos. We have our communicators, people who get the word out within and beyond our walls about who we are and what we're doing. You bring your money. It's the only money we have to do this work. And we have people who manage that money and make sure that it's used well. We have leaders who give up so much personal time to show up for meeting after meeting and do all the research and preparation, always learning more and helping to raise up new leaders. We have writers and readers and planners and party makers and fundraisers and organizers and cooks and media gurus. We have people who show up on Sundays to warmly greet newcomers and help them discover this faith and this congregation. And is there anyone here in the room who isn't thinking of at least one contribution I haven't even mentioned? I could not possibly mention them all. Every single one of these tasks is essential, absolutely, to the work of a community of prophecy. You do all of it for each other and for those still invisible others yet to come with great love. Together, these works create the embodiment of our progressive spirituality. Some UUs have even created a Google Doc listing the many ways people can offer support without participating in direct action. And people all across the country are adding their ideas to it. Pretty soon, I'll be posting it somewhere so that you can all have access to it. But for now, this. It says, first and foremost is showing up at church every week, singing loudly and clapping along, energetically supporting the activists and building up the energy of the congregation. So let's rise together now in body or spirit and get ready to do just that with hymn Come and Go With Me, number 1018.